Today on The Grave Talks, The Other Side with Karen Hollis. What causes spirits to return to the living? Do they always have a message? Do they intend on being seen and heard? Around 2014, a family in Connecticut had an unexpected visit from a young man who had perished on their local water tower many years before. The reason for his return to a house in a family he had no association with troubled the family and investigators alike. Karen Hollis was brought in to help understand and communicate with the spirit of the boy, who now insisted on being part of this family.
She had contacted Kurt Knapp, who's the co-founder of Goners, and was talking to him about her daughter, Macy, and how there were strange things happening in the house. And so typically what happens when somebody calls Ghosts of New England Research Society is they're really freaked out, you know. So she started talking about what seemed like some very benign things happening around the house. She had two teenage daughters, and the phenomena seemed to be focusing on Macy, which is her oldest at the time, who was in high school. And the girls kept buying hairbrushes, and the hairbrushes kept going missing. And at the time, Kurt kind of laughed and said, well, you know, are they misplacing them? What's going on? And this is often what happens is with the paranormal is something will ramp up. In other words, something benign seems to go missing and then reappear. Or the phenomena will, you know, seem like nothing big, and then it'll start to ramp up in the house. So hairbrushes started going missing. And so, you know, Kurt didn't think that was all that, you know, startling or anything like that. And he said, well, what else has happened? And then that's when the mother told the story about how her husband had told her that he was going fishing early in the morning one weekend, and that he was going to get up and he was just going to go fishing with his buddy because they live on the coastline. And so she rolled over one morning. She felt somebody, you know, right against her back. She knew it was her husband at the time, or thought it was. And she said to him, I thought you were going fishing. And whatever was in bed with her said, something like that, you know, just a growl kind of a thing. And she's like, what does that mean? She says, you know, I'm going to get up and I'll be right back. And so she went into their master bathroom. And when she came back, it was gone. And so she freaked out, went running around the house looking for her husband, saying, like, you were just here. All she saw was, you know, this kind of like a lump under the covers, okay, when she got up to walk away to their master bathroom. And when she came back, whatever it was gone. And she swore it was him. Okay, so now the phenomena kind of ramps up a little bit, because you can imagine if you think that you're in bed with your spouse and, you know, all of a sudden you walk away for 2 seconds and you come back and now that spouse is missing, nowhere to be found in the house. She called her husband on the cell phone. He was just about to push off on the boat to go fishing with his buddy. He said, well, I told you I was going fishing early in the morning. And she goes, but you were just here. Like, you were just in bed with me. He goes, no, I wasn't. I don't know who was in bed with you, but it wasn't me. And he laughed. And she said, no, you were just here. And that's when she knew that things were starting to get a little more serious in the house. The feeling of being watched all over the house, the entire family. And then it seemed to keep focusing on her daughter for whatever reason. So these were the things that started happening all over the house, where things would go missing, they'd come back. And that's pretty typical of what we've experienced when we've been, you know, looking at different cases. So that's kind of what was going on there. It wasn't until later that we kind of tied it into the water tower. It was late in the investigation, okay, when all that information kind of came through. And that came through after I came on the scene and we, you know, had gone there, set up our cameras. I banged on a wall and I said, you know, if anybody's here, go ahead and bang back. You know, I just want to make sure that what I'm hearing is correct. And you heard knock, knock, is that good, right out loud.
Wow.
And all of us heard it, including the family.
Early on, when this is all happening, and Mary's experiencing that phenomena in her bed, you know, Macy is having hairbrushes go missing and other activity. What is the husband thinking? Is he having anything happen to him at all, or is he just hearing all these stories secondhand from his family?
No, he said to me, I'm surrounded by estrogen. I've got two teenage girls and a wife, and I don't believe in any of this, and I have no idea what they're talking about. So he really wasn't thinking that this was anything until you know, his wife, Mary, just started to scream at him, listen, you've got to believe us that this is really happening. Now, what he didn't tell his wife was that he was an avid, auto guy, and he liked to do auto body repair. He liked to pick up, you know, cars that had kind of been smashed and kind of completely repair them in his garage, in his man cave. And he didn't tell his wife that he ran a power line for all those tools, okay, into the garage, and it was right under the bedroom. So go seek power sources, Tony, all right? And that's what allowed him to manifest the way that he did. So that power line was literally ungrounded, running directly under their bedroom. And it's right next to Macy's bedroom where all of the, you know, hairbrushes went missing and all the kind of creepy feeling, you know, you could hear the voice, you know, is that good, knocking back. So again, what we find is usually there's a generated source of power that is allowing whatever it is to show itself or manifest. So I believe that the dead are around us all the time. And it's not that they have nefarious, you know, intentions all the time. People are people, dead or alive. People are either good or bad, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you can't make anybody do anything that they don't want to do, including a ghost. So all this idea that we can sage them away or say the Our Father or whatever it is that your religious leaning is a bunch of bunk, in my opinion. Ghosts of New England Research Society is a research society for a reason. What we try to do is identify it. I can communicate with it. I might be able to broker a deal with it, whatever it is, okay, to leave you alone. But we always look for the power source to try to lessen the activity, or at least you won't hear the activity, or you won't see things moving around. So, you know, that's kind of the long and short of how this particular entity was able to show himself that way.
When you have a power source like that, and it's something that essentially fueled this initially to get that in and brought this about, I guess, so to speak, where you said, you know, sometimes you can talk to them, sometimes you can broker a deal, as you put it, to get things to calm down. That's just the one. If the power source is still there, and let's say, you know, the deal, for lack of a better term, has been brokered with the entity that's been causing the current stream of problems, isn't it just as easy then for something else to pop in if that power source is still in existence?
Theoretically, yeah. I mean, okay. Absolutely. Because, again, you know, I believe that, you know, ghost entities, whatever you want to call them, they're mm-hmm. pure energy. Mm-hmm. So they feed off of energy. So, yeah, I mean, you could have one, you could have three, you could have many, you know. I was in one house in Waterford, Connecticut, and I was taking some photographs in front of an old fireplace. So this is a house that's over 200 years old. And in the photograph, it was one of those, you know, old-time cameras. This was probably back in the 80s, okay, where, you know, it automatically developed, okay, the film. It was like one of those automatic developing film cameras.
Sure.
And in the picture, there's an old lady. You can see right through her. There's a little kid. Okay, you can see right through him. And then you see what looks like a cat, and you can see right through the cat. And so once I recognized that I had taken the photograph when it was like just teeming, pouring rain outside, it was the energy of the rain beating down on the house, because water is a conductor, that allowed me to see that in the photograph. When I asked the old lady what was the deal with the kid and the cat, she had no idea who these other two entities were. So they may have occupied different spaces and time historically within that home and did not know about each other, but yet stood in the same spot, which will blow your mind, you know. So we don't have answers for that. We just know that it can exist. It can be a historical overlay, or it could literally be an entity that wants to show itself because there's energy there.
Which is interesting, because sometimes we have stories and experiences where you have the entities of the other side clearly interacting with one another on the same plane, but usually they are of the same time period. Then sometimes you have exactly what you talked about, where maybe they were at different points in time and don't even know the two exist, but they're showing themselves to those in the present.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
What are some of the other power sources, for lack of a better term, that are fairly common that these things can feed off of to show themselves?
Well, I'll give you an example of something that we're going to be investigating, and I can't tell you the name of the business because, of course, that would be confidential between the owner and Ghost of New England Research Society. But there is a business that is essentially a high-end wine cellar. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so what this gentleman does is, if you have an exceptional wine from an exceptional year, he will store it in what used to be a nuclear bunker, okay? So it was turned into a storage facility that is climate controlled now. And there are generators within this cement bunker, which is a 10,000 square foot bunker. It used to house important documents for insurance professionals here in Hartford. Ever since they put in that climate-controlled system and that generator, the walls are 18 inches thick and they're concrete within this bunker. They're hearing the clinking of glasses. They're hearing, like, parties going around them as they're trying to work, because they take wines in and out. Like, let's say you have a wine, you're having a party, and you want his service to bring that wine back to your home, right, for that particular party. So they have to go down into the cellar in order to retrieve that particular wine in that particular rack in a particular row. They're seeing shadow figures going by the aisles. They're hearing, like I said, party-type behavior going on. They're smelling cigar smoke. They're hearing men playing poker down there. And so, you know, part of this may be a historical overlay because the people that owned that particular bunker before were insurance professionals, okay, at a time when it was all male-owned. So it may be that they're just hanging out down there. But I think it's based on the generator. Either the generator isn't grounded or they're feeding off of something.
Was this bunker used for parties at one point in time?
It wasn't used for parties, but what would happen is the gentleman that owned it, or the several people that owned it, they would use it like a man cave. Okay. In other words, you know, they had several families. This was back in the 60s when they were afraid that all hell was going to break loose for nuclear war. They had a place for their families to be in case all hell broke loose. Mm-hmm. And they would go down there and play poker.
Okay. Because my question was going to be, because I'm thinking bunker, I'm thinking, you know, places that typically aren't inhabited by anyone. It's more so storage. And if there's nobody that's really coming and going, why would there suddenly be these residual or conscious things going on in a setting where it had never happened?
Well, think about it. It's a, people that want to provide that kind of security for their family, right?
Sure.
Maybe a little conspiracy theory going on, you know, we're all going to go up in flames. Maybe not. I mean, you know, in the 1960s, that was a real possibility, as
sure.
You know. So, you know, they own this particular, huge bunker. They had places for their families to hide in case nuclear war happened. Mm-hmm. And now they're all dead.
Yeah.
So now this new generator comes in. Who knows if they've been there all along, mm-hmm. and nobody could hear them. You see my point?
Yeah.
And we don't know if it's just them or other people are partying down there. Who knows?
Sure. I mean, it makes total sense. And I think it's my question is almost very, I think, humanistic thinking, where it's like, well, if you weren't there before, why would you be there now? I think it's the same reason that, well, if I had never been to this restaurant before, why would I go there now? Because I'm curious and I want to go explore it.
Just as
we would in the living, you know, I think the dead can do the same. And they're wandering around and checking out places they may not have checked out before. They don't necessarily always have to have had a personal connection in life to a area to be there in the in their death.
These are wealthy individuals. I mean, these are people who, you know, they consider this to be like their kind of spot, their go-to spot to play poker and hang out and, you know, do whatever. Yeah. And I'm sure that what it is it's curiosity, right? Because there's also a ton of renovation on that property. So you'll hear all the time where there's, you know, you may have a historic property, you'll have renovation happen. And then because something's been disturbed and somebody was attached to it emotionally in life, you may not hear them around you screaming, hey, you know, that used to be mine and what are you doing tearing it apart? But you put in a power source that's not grounded, now you're hearing ghostly voices. Now you're actually hearing what's going on around you.
What does the grounding do to change it?
All it does is it shuts down the ability of the phenomena to manifest around you. In other words, you know, if something's going to throw a glass off of a table, it has to have a power source in order to get that momentum to throw that glass. So if the power source is grounded, that individual may be there. Maybe they're trying to pick up that glass and throw it because they're angry about some kind of something that's happening in the area, but they won't be able to do it because they don't have enough energy to make it happen.
Okay. That I get that. That makes sense. Let's go back to the story a little bit with Mary and Marcy, her daughter and her husband. How common is it in your experience for an entity to only target select members of a family and in turn causing some confusion and sometimes conflict like there was initially between Mary and her husband?
It's not very common, Tony. I mean, to be honest with you, we get hundreds of calls for people that think that they're haunted or think that there's something paranormal going on. It's all very explainable. And then to have a particular entity target a particular family for a particular reason is even a more rare event. And so, you know, without a medium or somebody who can actually communicate with whatever's going on, we probably never would have made the connection between the water tower, this boy who felt guilty that his girlfriend had fallen off the water tower and had died. The story, the backstory on this is that this gentleman committed suicide about a year and a half after the original death of his girlfriend. And his parents lived down the street from the home in which these people had the haunting going on. So, in other words, he committed suicide in the garage of the parents, wandered down the street, saw the power source coming out of the garage where Macy's dad was doing body work, wandered in, curious, started kind of feeding off the energy of the ungrounded power source, okay, to do the body work, went into the household. And what's more fun for a teenage boy to do than to hang out with some teenage girls and mess with their minds? And so that's how it all started. And I think he was very lonely. I don't believe that people are earthbound. I think they're bound only by their want to be here. And my sense of it is that he wasn't always in that house, okay, in the Sherman's house. I think that he probably went back and forth between his elderly parents' home and Macy's, you know, bedroom and that home, wanting to be a part of, you know, still that youth and that family, couldn't move on. And, you know, so wanted to kind of do a redo, I guess is what I want to say. Knew Mary, the mother, thought that Macy was actually Mary at first because they look alike. And I mean, exactly alike, not just a little alike. So when we went in to investigate, one of the things that was interesting was Kurt Knapp put his iPad down on Macy's bed, and we kind of left it there as part of the investigation. And on the iPad, we caught something touching the iPad, and you heard, whoa. So iPads weren't invented when this kid died. Mm-hmm. That was probably the 70s, I want to guess.
Okay.
So it's interesting, you know?
So my next question was going to be, what time period is this from where he had passed? Is there any validation to the story of the death? I mean, is this something that's been documented that you've been able to look back on and go, yep, this is who I think it is specifically?
Well, according to the mom, Mary, okay, she was not at the water tower when the event happened, but she remembered that it did happen in their town. And I believe we do have documentation that there was a death off of a water tower in the town. In the episode, the name of the town was changed to protect the family, because we try to protect the address and also the town in which the people live in, because, you know, again, if they ever want to sell their home,
sure,
you know, we want to make sure that we protect their identity. So, yes, we did check the historical record on it, and there had been a death in this town off the water tower. And, you know, the mom did remember what had happened in the town, and she remembered the boy whose girlfriend died, and she remembered him. And then we kind of connected it to the fact that the parents lived up the street. But ghosts or the dead speak in symbolism. So when we had everybody in the same master bedroom, and I knocked on the wall and I said, you know, if you're here, I want you to knock back. And we heard, is that good? That's when I started asking this young man, all right, let's get to the bottom of this. Why are you here? Why are you attached to Macy? What is it that you want? And he started showing me images of a water tower in my mind. So they use symbolism. So I started to talk to Mary and the family about, he's showing me a water tower. He's showing me a body falling off a water tower. He's showing me a garage and a suicide. And that's when it all came together. And the mother said, oh my God, I know what that is. You know, I know what that is. And that's when it kind of all clicked. And then she came out with the story, and I heard a very clear yes. Okay, you know, that's my name. That's who I was. I remember, you know, Mary. So I said to him in my head, you know, that's how they communicate. In other words, through thought forms, I said, so what do you want? Why are you here? It's certainly not to steal, you know, hairbrushes from teenage girls for the rest of your existence. And he said, I just want my life back. I want a family for a while.
Okay.
And I said, okay, so if they allow you to be around without scaring them, you know, will you eventually go? And the answer was yes. So, you know, again, people wanted to immediately be exorcised or tossed out of the house. But, you know, I just think that this particular entity needed some time, mm-hmm. you know, and really needed some compassion from that family. And once they understood that they could coexist with it, you know, the brokerage deal between me and this young boy was like, you know, you can't show up in Mary's bed. You can't, like, just pop into Macy's bedroom. You know, if you're going to be around, then, you know, you can be around, but you can't act like this. And it was understood, and they haven't had much go on since then. So it's being acknowledged and acknowledging the pain that entity went through. Mm-hmm. We don't know how long it'll stick around, but they haven't had much else go on, which is kind of interesting, you know?
Yeah.
That was a really interesting episode, very interesting story, very unique.
Was there anything that was done with the power source that you had discovered for the tools that he had run? Was that ever addressed as far as, you know, just in case, let's change this up?
Oh, yeah, that was the first thing I said to the husband. I said, you know, as a part of all of this, you've got to get an electrician out here and get that thing grounded. One, it's not good to have that kind of energy running under a bedroom, right? Because we have no idea what that's going to do to your health. You know, two, it's allowing him to manifest, like literally manifest. So that's got to get grounded, you know, or removed, or something has to happen.
Sure.
And, you know, and so all that was addressed. And I think that, too, you know, helped to calm everything down. So, you know, sometimes there are very real reasons, you know, why you're seeing things happen in your home. And you have to go to the more rational side and say, okay, let me get an electrician here. Let me get a plumber in here. Let's make sure everything is the way it needs to be, you know, before jumping to conclusions that it's something evil. Mm-hmm. And I think that the ghost shows want to make it sexy, right? They want to make it so that it's, you know, it's watchable.
Sure.
And so they didn't go too far outside the bounds because it was scary to this family mm-hmm. in that particular episode. But every episode that I'm in, that I'm involved in, I'm kind of changing the model of how they're ending all this. And in that particular episode, it felt a little abrupt to me because it was like, you know, here you have all this scary stuff happen, and then Karen just says, hey, live with it, you know. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there is no other way to deal with these things aside from to approach them from like a, you know, a real rational approach to it.
Sure.
But television needs to make it scarier than what it is.
Sure. No, I understand how all that works. The boys' family, were they still around in the area, do you know, when these events were occurring?
Apparently the mother and father were still alive, yes.
Okay.
Right. Right, but we did not approach them on this because, of course, we don't want to re-traumatize them.
Sure, sure. Do you know if they ever, you know, found out about it? That hey, this, you know, this was kind of focused on possibly, you know, the ghost of your son. Did you ever hear anything of that nature?
I never heard anything about it, and it wasn't in our wheelhouse to say anything about it, you
sure.
know, because again, it's all conjecture and theory,
yeah,
you
course.
Know, all we have is the ghostly voices on SoundCloud and what we have on our audio and what Mary remembers. And then of course, you know, I was the bridge between the evidence and the explanation on it. So, the short answer is no, we never approached them.
Okay. A very compelling story. Since we have some more time here, I'd love to talk about another one of the stories that I know you were featured on A Haunting. That would be the episode, the Well to Hell episode. Another, you know, very
Perfect.
Very
yep.
compelling story. Would you like to give us the background on that and what happened?
Oh, sure. That'd be awesome. There's a joke about the Well to Hell, and that was when the original episode came out. I said, what a crazy name for that segment. I wonder who named that, right? Mm-hmm. And my husband, Mark, was laughing at me. He said, you named it. I said, what are you talking about? And he said, go look at the segment. And I remember the producer saying to me, you know, hey, Karen, you know, how deep was that well? And I said, well, it looked like it went right to hell. And that's how the episode was named, which
okay.
is kind of funny. But, you know, the backstory on the Mark Corvo house is this, that Mark Corvo is very much an empath. There are a lot of people in the world who can feel things outside of themselves. They get very upset when they're watching the news, or you know, they see something that's particularly disturbing. And Mark, I think, always had the ability to draw spirit to him. Okay, so I think he was a really sensitive person, a sensitive kid. I didn't know that at the time. Again, he had contacted Kurt Knapp because that was the, you know, the go-to as the founder, and started to play the EVPs for him. And so by the time I got called in, we started asking a lot of questions about the house itself. So the Corvo house that sits in Cromwell had two different areas to it. It had a slave's quarters to it, and then it had what would have been the owner's quarters. So again, it's a really old historic home. When Mark Corvo's grandfather bought the house, he was unaware that there was an entire cemetery behind the house. The owner, prior to Corvo, had taken headstones and kind of placed them down, okay, and had sodded over the gravestones and then seeded over that. So the backyard just looked like kind of a big mound or a big hill, and you would never know that there was a graveyard out back. So what's not told in the episode, that's part of the paranormal exploding there, is that when Mark took over the home, there had been a septic failure. And so the company that came out to replace the septic went and took a metal rod and went all the way around the house and said, you know, the only place that we can like put this new septic is in the backyard because you have ledge everywhere else. There's just no way with the new, you know, regulations and licensure and permits that we can put it where it used to be. So we're going to have to dig up the backyard. So they dug up the backyard. Now, imagine, if you will, you're a slave. You get dragged over here to New England. It's the late 1700s, early 1800s, somewhere in there. You're forced to work, okay, in this home for these owners your entire life. You're finally put to rest in the slaves area of the graveyard that's in the back of the house. And suddenly and unexpectedly, you're dug up. And you're not just dug up with your own kind, you're dug up with the owners. Okay. So, you know, everything was pretty much dust. There was nothing there. Okay. No, the bones were gone at that point in time, but the gravestones were there. And, so one of them was like not crushed or unharmed or whatever you want to call it. It was around Halloween and Mark thought it was kind of a cool thing. And he dragged it inside the house and he put it by the fireplace. And that's where the story begins, that the paranormal starts to explode in the house.
That wraps up part one of our interview with Karen Hollis about The Other Side. In part two of our interview, we'll discuss another haunting that she was a part of and learning about what was known as the Portal to Hell. Also, how one of the men involved, Mark, and his family discovered that their backyard had a graveyard in it. Who were some of the entities that were haunting Mark's house? What practices are most effective in drawing entities and expelling them? How does alcohol play a role in haunting encounters? And was Mark able to remove the entities that were haunting his property? Also, how does water play a role in the dead returning to the living? Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.